Welcome back to Books with Bert. I'm Bert Folsom, and I'm continuing today with my book, New Deal or Raw Deal. And the title of my episode today is, Did the New Deal Make Things Worse? But before we get into today's episode, I want to remind you that if you like my podcasts and you want to learn more wonderful and forgotten stories in American history, don't forget to review and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get podcasts. It really helps with those ratings. And don't forget to share with your friends and family, too. Yeah, the title of this podcast is Did the New Deal Make Things Worse? That's an interesting question because the New Deal was designed to have programs. Franklin Roosevelt had programs to give to people who either were unemployed or underemployed, and this would help reduce the unemployment rate by giving people jobs. So how could it actually make things worse? That's what we're going to get into today because, in fact, the New Deal did indeed make things worse. I want to start with some examples that most people and most textbook writers talk about. The first is the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act. We had about one-fourth of American people were farmers back in 1930, and prices were low. Prices were low for farm products. And so the question was, Roosevelt was thinking, how can I make things better for the farmer? He came up with a solution that was given to him by a college professor. The solution was so remarkably bad, it could only have been invented by a college professor. It was Harvard professor John D. Black. He was an economist. And his idea was, hey, if farm prices are low, one way to get them up is to pay farmers not to produce. Let me say that again. Farmers, let's say you have a 200-acre farm, allow farmers to take maybe 20 or 25% of their land out of circulation. If they had a 200-acre farm, take maybe 40 or 50 acres out of circulation. Pay these farmers not to produce on that land. The farmer would get increased wages from the money he's getting not to produce. And also, because there would be less crop being produced, therefore the prices of those crops would go up, the farmer would benefit, and that would be a solution to low farm prices. Well, look at the problems here. They are many. The AAA, as it operated in practice, was fluid and sometimes really hard to describe. Much discretionary power was centralized in the Secretary of Agriculture, and the specifics, you know, the prices and which crops to subsidize, which acreage and how much to set aside, could vary from crop to crop. These were issues that the Secretary of Agriculture strongly influenced. Henry Wallace, who was Roosevelt's man for the job, made sure the bill was written that way. It's going to centralize a lot of power in the federal government. Therefore, we had a huge expansion in the Department of Agriculture. More bureaucrats were needed to determine which crops needed to be reduced, how much reduction should be made, and what price should be paid for each crop, and what should be the processing tax for the flour mills and textile companies who were assuming the burden financially for the money that was going to be going to the farmers. Beyond this, the Department of Agriculture used the 3,000 county agents and hired about 100,000 men from farming counties all over America to help enforce and determine the correct acreage each farmer would be allowed to set aside for cash. Under the AAA, farmers could refuse to be paid not to plant, but most farmers found it profitable to farm the taxpayers and not their soil. In 1933, which was Franklin Roosevelt's first year as president and the first year we had the AAA in effect, a wheat farmer could remove 40 of his 200 acres from cultivation and be paid about $10 an acre not to produce on that land. He was not allowed to plant, secretly or overtly, on any of the 40 acres he had set aside. However, he could pick his worst 40 acres to set aside, even land he normally didn't plant on. Also, he could use his government subsidy to buy fertilizer to improve the yield on the land he did cultivate. In fact, the huge increase in the sale of fertilizer in 1933 and 1934 reveals that many farmers did just that, which of course forced those federal bureaucrats to recalculate the set-asides for various crops based on the ever-increasing yields per acre. The supervising and regulating of millions and millions of farmers so expanded the Department of Agriculture that it became, with the possible exception of the Post Office and later the Defense Department, the largest federal employer in the government. H.V. Kaltenborn, a national radio commentator and an admirer of Henry Wallace, described how, when he visited Henry Wallace, what he saw and the scope of the bureaucratic machinery set up under the new Agricultural Adjustment Act. Here's what Mr. Kaltenborn said. "The amount of regulatory machinery essential to administer the AAA was a fearsome thing to behold for anyone who believed in the American farmer as master of his own domain. Thousands of inspectors had to be sent into the fields. Thousands of accountants had to keep track of what each inspector reported about, what each farmer was growing, and what benefits every grower or non-grower was entitled to receive. As soon as the AAA helped one group of farmers, other groups were affected and called for similar benefits and protective regulations." Kaltenborn went on to say, "If one particular crop was controlled, the farmer would plant excessively in other crops. If acreage was controlled, he would use only his best acres. That produced a new surplus, which also had to be controlled. Farmers were paid millions of dollars not to produce crops, while President Roosevelt was telling us that one-third of our people were ill-fed. For every problem that was solved, two or three new problems were created." Kaltenborn expressed the problems with government trying to get into the business of farming and the problems of trying to subsidize farmers by paying them not to produce. With millions of acres out of production, American farmers actually underproduced in many crops in 1935. The United States had, for almost the first time in its national history, become a major food importing nation. In 1933, the U.S. was plowing under 10 million acres of cotton, killing 3 million piglets. The United States was importing 36 million bales of cotton in 1935, 2 million pounds of ham and bacon. We were also importing other basic commodities, butter, corn, even wheat. The importing of all of these farm products increased taxes and expenses for almost every American. They simply had to pay more for their food and clothing. The farmers were being subsidized, production was less, for the most part, and the costs of food and clothing increased. So everybody who was not a farmer was hurt by the AAA. It prolonged the Great Depression, and it indeed made things worse in the United States. But the United States, we have a separation of powers. Congress is not absolute. The president, also with Congress, is not absolute. The Supreme Court is able to check in. The Supreme Court declared the AAA unconstitutional in a 6-3 vote during Roosevelt's first term. Thus, farmers would no longer be paid not to produce unless Roosevelt could find a way, perhaps on a technicality, to reinstitute a new AAA. That's exactly what he did. He instituted a new AAA, and it would pass muster. Now, the interesting question here, why would Roosevelt even want to redo the AAA? It was harming the American economy. People paid more for the food that they were eating, for the clothes they were wearing. The answer is that Roosevelt wanted to win the votes of farmers. If farmers were paid not to produce, and if Roosevelt started the program that allowed them to be paid not to produce, then he would benefit and get the farmers' votes. Now, there were some people in his administration who said, wait a minute, everybody's going to want to be paid not to produce. I know in my teaching of many years at Hillsdale College, I would have enjoyed it very much if the president of Hillsdale College would have come up to me and said, Bert, we're going to pay you not to produce. That never happened, and it's not likely to happen to any of you listening to this podcast either. But it did happen to farmers in the 1930s. Roosevelt stood behind that, and he carried every farm state in the Midwest the next time he ran for president in 1936. The person running against him, Alf Landon, was the governor of Kansas. But even the governor of Kansas could not carry his own state of Kansas because Roosevelt had started the AAA, which paid farmers not to produce. And Landon had no answer when the farmer said, you mean you're going to take away our subsidy? The best he could come up with is to say, well, maybe we can run it better than they can. But farmers went with the man who gave them the subsidy, not the person who promised to improve it. So the AAA made things worse in the United States. It prolonged the Great Depression. But oddly enough, it won Roosevelt votes. And thus, he will continue in office even as the Great Depression lingers on. Let's look at another major program that Franklin Roosevelt had under what he called his New Deal, and that is the National Recovery Act. This was also abbreviated NRA, like the National Rifle Association, but this NRA under Roosevelt is the National Recovery Act. The National Recovery Act was dealing with low prices that were being paid to corporations, industries, for the products they produced. In other words, the corporate owners, the people who worked there, all were not getting high prices for the products they were selling during the Great Depression. Roosevelt's solution, just as it was to pay farmers not to produce, it was a little bit different with the NRA. Here, he allowed businessmen to get together, to collude, say car makers, steel rail makers, textile makers, furniture makers, all industrial goods producers, he allowed them to get together, the leaders in their industry, and set the prices for their products. In other words, General Motors and Chrysler would get together and decide what should be paid for a Chevrolet or a Dodge. Naturally, they set high prices. And the NRA rules were anybody who sold lower than the high price that was set by the car makers, anybody who sold for a lesser price would be subject to a jail term. When Roosevelt introduced the NRA in 1933, his first year in office, he said, "History will probably record the National Recovery Act as the most important and far-reaching legislation ever enacted by the American Congress." Well, in a way, he may have been right. Far-reaching it was. Hugh Johnson, who was the man Roosevelt put at the head of the NRA, called the NRA, quote, "a holy thing, the greatest social advance since the days of Jesus Christ," end quote. Now, the question is, how is the AAA going to work in practice? And the answer is, people are going to have to pay more for shirts, the clothes they make from the textile dealers, they're going to have to pay more for cars, for furniture, and naturally that creates a problem. Now, the other problem is created by those people who wanted to give consumers a discount. Let me give you an example. Jacob Magid of Jersey City, New Jersey, was in the business of pressing pants. That is, if you wanted your pants pressed, you could come in and he would do the job. He'd been working for 22 years in Jersey City, New Jersey, and his low prices and quality work had kept him competitive with larger tailor shops in the better parts of town. People had to go out of their way to come to Magid's shop. Now, the NRA Cleaners and Dyers Code demanded that 40 cents be charged to press a suit. Magid, despite repeated warnings, insisted on giving his customers discounts and only charging them 35 cents. He said, "You can't tell me how to run my business." When threatened with jail, he said, "If you can send me to jail, go ahead." That was exactly what the head of the NRA code wanted to do. A man named Abraham Traube, who was the director of the NRA Code Authority for the Cleaners and Dyers Board of Trade, said this, "If we could do the same thing to Magid that we do in New York City, we could get the whole industry in line." However, many editorialists sided with Magid. Even the Washington Post did so. The Washington Post said, quote, "It didn't matter if Magid had to charge less than the bright and shiny tailor shop up the street if he wanted to continue to exist. The law said he couldn't." The New York Herald Tribune said, "For a parallel, it is necessary to go to the fascist or communist states of Europe." Magid did not sign the NRA code, but not all men who refused to sign this code could easily be intimidated. In the auto industry, Henry Ford refused to sign the NRA code for automobiles, and he refused to jack up his car prices as his competitors were doing. "I do not think this country is ready to be treated like Russia for a while," Ford wrote in his notebook. "There is a lot of pioneer spirit here yet." However, General Motors, Chrysler, and the smaller independents eagerly signed the NRA codes that regulated their production, the wages, the prices, and the hours of work. Ford was astounded. His colleagues preferred stability and government regulation to competition and free trade. In the face of strong pressure from the NRA, Ford refused and continued to refuse to sign the auto code. He defied the law, pronouncing it un-American and unconstitutional. Hugh Johnson, the NRA chief, and President Roosevelt, however, wanted government control as well as compliance. They tried to pressure Ford into signing the code, and when he refused, they tried force. Ford would receive no government contracts until he signed. And with the large increase in government agencies during the 1930s, that meant a huge business. For example, the bid of a Ford group on 500 trucks for the Civilian Conservation Corps, one of Roosevelt's programs, was $169,000 below the next best offer. The government announced, however, that it would reject Ford's bid and pay $169,000, tax dollars, more for the trucks because Ford refused to sign the auto code. As Roosevelt announced at a press conference, "We have got to eliminate the purchase of Ford cars for the government because Ford has not gone along with the general NRA agreement." They did not send Henry Ford to jail. That would have been too big a publicity disaster. But they did not allow Ford to make any successful bids for government contracts to sell his trucks or automobiles. The Supreme Court, when it got a hold of the National Recovery Act, this whole idea of allowing businessmen to set the prices for the products they were making and force compliance in those prices and allow no one to compete with them, needless to say, the Supreme Court did not like that, and they ruled the NRA unconstitutional. One of the justices even laughed at it during the hearing. The Supreme Court voted 9-0. A unanimous vote to strike down the National Recovery Act. That decision by the Supreme Court striking down both the AAA and the NRA prompted Roosevelt, after he won his re-election, to pack the Supreme Court. He tried to pack the Supreme Court by allowing the Supreme Court to add 6 new justices, which he would appoint. Roosevelt was not successful in this endeavor, but it shows his effort to centralize power in the federal government. That was a desire of Franklin Roosevelt, not really and not necessarily to get the United States out of the Great Depression. The NRA prolonged the Great Depression. It's difficult to find any historian even who defends the NRA with any kind of effort. The NRA was a disaster, and it was struck down by the Supreme Court, and no longer could businessmen sell their products at prices that the businessmen dictated, and customers would be forced to buy those products. One thing always to keep in mind is that many of Roosevelt's programs were designed as vote getters. not to promote recovery, but to promote the Democratic Party. For example, we had 7 states that were major producers of silver. The senators from those states were aggressive and influential in Congress. Roosevelt wanted to win those states at election time. As a special interest group, the silver bloc, that is, those senators and congressmen from those 7 states, wanted a special subsidy. Let me explain how this works. The world price for silver during 1933, Roosevelt's first year in office, was around 40 to 45 cents an ounce. Now, even that price was a sharp rise from the previous year. But the silver producers wanted more. Senator Elmer Thomas had an amendment to the AAA that gave the president wide powers in buying silver and setting its price. Thus, in December 1933, the president began his subsidy to the silver bloc. He promised to buy the nation's annual output of silver at a sharply increased price of 64.5 cents an ounce. In other words, around the world, silver would sell for 40 to 45 cents an ounce, but in the United States, the government would buy it at 64.5 cents an ounce. This subsidy for silver helped the president carry all 7 silver states when he was running for re-election in 1936. Meanwhile, the production of silver in the United States more than doubled during the 1930s. As long as the silver miners could produce silver at an inflated price, they increased their production and they prospered. However, the taxpayers are going to be the losers here, and the national debt is going to double between 1933, when Roosevelt took office, and 1940, the year that his second term ended. Roosevelt's ability through programs like the AAA, the NRA, and his silver purchase helped him with voters in specific groups. The AAA with the farmers, the NRA with various businessmen, and the silver bloc with his Silver Purchase Act. The doubling of the national debt and the increase of taxes were going to hurt the American economy. Thus, the New Deal, lots of effort went forth, but it is going to prolong the Great Depression. It will make things worse. And that leads to Henry Morgenthau's observation in 1939. We have tried spending money. We are spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work. Morgenthau ought to know. He was the Secretary of Treasury. He was a friend of Franklin Roosevelt. They were good buddies. They would have breakfast together. Their wives would go shopping together. But when it came to the New Deal, Morgenthau began increasingly to recognize that these spending programs were not working. I'll read that again. In 1939, Morgenthau said, "We have tried spending money. We are spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work." He went on to say, "I want people to get a job. I want to see people get enough to eat. We have never made good on our promises. I say after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much unemployment as when we started, and an enormous debt to boot." The New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt prolonged the Great Depression. Sadly, it made things worse for Americans. A generation of Americans will suffer during the 1930s under the New Deal. In thinking about the Great Depression, one book I'd like to recommend that I haven't mentioned yet is Gene Smiley's book, Rethinking the Great Depression. It's an excellent book. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you get your podcasts. And if you like today's episode and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and for conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.